Thank you very much, Vice-Chancellor, for that flattering introduction. Dr. Searby, Mrs. Searby, Chancellor, Vice-Chancellor, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to deliver the Richard Searby Oration here at Deakin University, or at least here in honour of Deakin University. I am honoured to follow the esteemed speakers who have preceded me in delivering this oration. Dr. Searby has had a singularly impressive career throughout which he has made a great contribution to the community of Australia in many different areas. As I read his record, one area with which he has had little obvious direct involvement has been that of finance, perhaps unfortunately, as it could well have benefited from his guidance. And it is the current state of the financial sector that I wish to talk about today. So, as you are all aware, the global financial system has been in a state of turmoil for more than 5 years now. The repercussions of this has been widespread, although thankfully Australia has been spared the worst of the impact. But in other parts of the world, most obviously Europe, the United States and the United Kingdom, the fallout from the financial crisis has seen millions lose their jobs, many for a number of years. This is most stark in Greece and Spain at the moment, where around one quarter of the workforce is unemployed. Young people entering the workforce in those two countries have little prospect of finding meaningful employment anytime soon, an experience that can scar their income prospects over the rest of their working lives and runs the risk of leading to a dangerous breakdown in social cohesion. This crisis has been very much financial in its genesis, but with losses that have extended to all parts of the global economy. Unlike some recent downturns that the world has experienced, the recovery in a number of countries has been particularly protracted this time around. In a number of countries, even some 5 years on now, the level of output in 2007 has yet to be reattained. That represents a sizable loss of income and wealth for a very large number of people. So tonight, I'm going to talk about one of the elements that has contributed to this financial crisis being so long-lasting, and which, unfortunately, might mean that there is still some way yet for it to run. So the issue I want to focus on is the importance of trust in banking and finance more generally, hence the title of my talk today. So credo is the Latin for I believe, from which we get the word credit, while fido is the Latin for I trust, from which we get fiduciary and fidelity. So credit is fundamentally an issue of trust. Without trust, we don't have credit. And that lack of credit is a phenomenon which is playing out in a number of countries around the world at the moment, although again, thankfully, not here in Australia. The lack of trust is contributing to the unwillingness of financial institutions to extend credit and the difficulty some governments are having in obtaining financing. In turn, the lack of credit growth is exerting a major restraint on the economic recoveries in a number of countries around the world. In the post-war period, easier monetary policy has invariably helped foster a rebound in economic growth following a recession. An important transmission channel for monetary policy, the take effect, has almost always been a pickup in lending to businesses and households. That is clearly not happening in many countries at the moment. Central banks in those countries are reaching deep into their toolkits to try and revive lending and foster economic recovery. But the lack of trust is significantly curtailing the ability of the normal implementation of policy tools, both monetary and fiscal, to engender a sustainable economic recovery. So with that by way of introduction, the outline of my structure of my talk today is to firstly discuss the role that the financial sector plays in the economy. Then I will examine the crucial role that trust plays in financial intermediation and ensuring that the financial system runs smoothly. Following that, I will document the breakdown of trust that has occurred over the past 5 years. And then to finish on hopefully a slightly more positive note, I will outline some of the avenues that might be taken to restore trust in the financial system. So some of these themes are addressed in a speech entitled Credit is Trust, delivered by a colleague of mine at the Bank of England, Andy Haldane, in September 2009. So Andy highlighted the reduction in trust that had taken place in the previous 2 years. So they were basically the first 2 years of the financial crisis. But 3 years on from 2009, the situation is even worse than Andy talked about. The lack of trust in the financial system has intensified. Distrust has spread beyond the finance system to other institutions. And this is most evident in Europe at the moment, where there is a lack of trust in some quarters in the longevity of the currency, the euro, and a lack of trust of some European governments that they will repay their creditors in full. And in the case of Greece, this lack of trust that they would be fully repaid actually proved to be well-founded. This diminished trust in political and economic institutions is a particularly worrying development. I fear that the path back will be a long one. In all walks of life, including finance, trust takes a long time to build, but can be quickly and easily shattered. So to set the scene, I will start with a brief description of what the finance sector actually does. And I hope I can avoid being too jargonistic here, but please forgive me if I lapse into economist speak every once in a while. So the finance sector plays an important role in the functioning of the economy, primarily through intermediation. Simply put, the finance sector sits between savers and borrowers. It takes the funds it raised from savers through, for example, deposits, and then lends it to those who wish to borrow, be they businesses, governments, or households. If the system is working well, it allocates the funds to their most productive use. This benefits the savers whose money is being invested profitably, and the economy and in society at large benefit too. It is important to note that the finance sector is an intermediate sector. It is not at the end of a production chain producing something which directly generates utility for society. It is a critical link along the way, the oil that keeps the economy ticking over, though, even though it is not at the end of any production chain. When that oil dries up that the financial sector provides, the economic engine starts to malfunction and can ultimately grind to a halt, as we have seen in a number of countries. In that regard, the financial sector is different from other parts of the economy. It is one of the reasons it is subject to considerably more regulation and oversight than other parts of the economy, though clearly the experience of the past few years indicates that in many parts of the world, that oversight and regulation were seriously deficient. When the finance sector stops functioning properly, it has knock-on effects to all parts of the economy in a way that other sectors generally don't. The experience at the end of 2008, following the collapse of Lehman Brothers, demonstrated this point starkly. The contraction in the global economy at that time was breathtaking in its rapidity, but also in its simultaneity, basically affected all parts of the world at exactly the same time and to roughly the same degree of severity. That was something which had just basically not been seen before. I will now step a bit deeper into the process of financial intermediation, to provide a better sense of where trust comes into the process. Again, apologies if this gets a bit too arcane, but hopefully you can bear with me. So why do financial intermediaries exist? Why don't I, as a saver, lend directly to you, the business that actually wants to borrow? So one of the main reasons is because of the presence of what economists refer to as asymmetric information. Asymmetric information arises when I know more about my situation than you do. It would be very difficult for an individual saver to know when they were lending to a business what that business was actually going to do with the funds it was being borrowed, whether they were going to put it to a productive purpose, and most importantly, whether that business would be in a position to repay the loan when it actually becomes due. An individual is just not likely to be able to have the expertise to make that assessment. A financial institution, such as a bank, on the other hand, that is practiced in credit assessment, can reduce these information asymmetries. When a bank makes a loan, it does the due diligence on the lender and assesses the capacity of the lender to repay. While the due diligence cannot completely eliminate the information asymmetry, it can allow the bank to make a reasonable assessment of the risk incurred in making the loan. On the basis of that risk assessment, the lender charges the borrower an interest rate to compensate for the risk incurred. With an appropriately varied portfolio of loans, then, the bank should not be overly exposed to any particular development. The risk is mutualised. If there is a problem with one loan, the lender should be earning sufficient interest on the rest of its loans to cover that loss. So the lender, and thereby the savers who provided the funds to the lender, are compensated for the risk incurred. Relative to lending their own funds directly, the savers are benefiting both from the hopefully professional risk assessment by the bank that reduces the information asymmetry, and they are also benefiting from that risk mutualisation. So one difficulty in this process that is apparent from what I've just said is the possibility that the risks in a portfolio of loans are correlated. So in plain English, when one loan goes bad, how likely is it that other loans will go bad at the same time? For example, in an economic downturn where there is a rise in unemployment, a lender might find that more loans are becoming problematic than expected because they are all being affected by the realisation of the same risk. The interest rate charged may have been sufficient to compensate the lender for one realisation of the risk, but may not have been adequate for a large number of simultaneous realisations of that risk. So in addition to intermediating funds, one can also think of the financial sector intermediating risk. So as I've just said, a financial institution has a wide range of loans on its books. By holding a diverse range of risk, the institution is, in theory, less vulnerable to the realisation of any one of those risks. But a financial institution doesn't always hold all the risks on its own books. Through channels such as securitisation, a financial institution can also distribute the risk around the financial system to other institutions that are, again, at least in theory, better placed to hold that risk. So who might be better placed to take on these risks? Some possible candidates are pension or superannuation funds, insurance companies, university endowments that should have long horizons and a diversified portfolio of assets. So it's an interesting question to ask whether it is better for a bank to pool the risks on its own books or whether it is better for the risk to be off the books of the banks and instead be distributed around the system. So if the risks are distributed around the system, the bank making the loan may be less inclined to do the appropriate amount of due diligence as they are no longer so directly exposed to the consequences. In principle, whoever buys the risk from the bank should also do an appropriate amount of due diligence. But the experience of the past few years shows that the more changed they are in that process, the more removed the end holder of the risk is from the originator of the risk, the worse the process of due diligence becomes. So let me give an example. The most obvious one is the US subprime situation. So in that process, there are a large number of links in the chain. There was obviously the original borrower. That borrower tended to borrow from a mortgage broker. The mortgage broker then passed the loan on to someone who collated a whole bunch of mortgages together, often a bank of some sort or another. The bank packaged those mortgages together into a security. The bank then took the security, sold it off its books, sold it on to another institution such as a pension fund. In turn, there are a large number of products which were derived on top of that security in form of things such as CDOs, of which a number of Australian councils have some familiarity. So there was a whole bunch of products by the time it ended up in the portfolio of a New South Wales council, it was a long, long way removed from some individual borrowing to buy a home in Las Vegas. So a lot of steps in that chain. In principle, everyone could have done due diligence along the way. As it turns out, most people didn't do any due diligence along the way. As I said, there was a long gap between that borrower in Las Vegas and that Sydney City Council. On the other hand, if the bank, instead of selling that risk on to someone else, holds too much risk on its balance sheet, and if too many of those risks crystallise, the bank is likely to find that its ability to continue to intermediate funds is severely curtailed. It will cut back on its lending, what's generally known as a credit crunch, worsening the economic environment. There are plenty of examples in this through history, including in the current crisis. So conceivably, risk should be intermediated just as much as funds are intermediated. These considerations are currently at play in the debate over the so-called Volcker Rule in the United States and the ring fencing proposed in the Vickers report on the UK banking system. The conclusion reached in both those cases is that it is better to separate the investment banking or risk generation arm of financial institutions from the commercial banking or regular lending arm of those institutions. Then, if some risk blows up in the investment arm, there is not a detrimental spillover to the commercial bank that crimps its ability to continue lending, Hopefully, this limits the impact on the overall economy. Alternatively, one can consider a world of fractional risk banking, analogous to fractional reserve banking. I'm just going to drop into some economic jargon here just for a minute. But with fractional reserve banking, what goes on there is I don't lend, when you deposit your money with me, I don't lend all the money that you've deposited out. I actually hold on to some. So that means that I've got a bit of money left around so that I can repay you, a depositor, should you decide to withdraw the funds at short notice. As long as all the depositors don't want the money back at once, that is, as long as there isn't a bank run, then I am fine. So one can think similarly in terms of fractional reserve banking, in terms of fractional risk banking. In the case of fractional risk banking, I would retain some part of the exposure, some part of the risk on my own balance sheet, rather than pass it all on to you. That would give me some incentive to monitor the risk and to continue to do the due diligence. I would keep what's often described as some skin in the game. So with that, spending a bit of time talking about how the financial sector actually operates, and as I said, the key point is that it is a financial intermediary. It takes funds from one part of the economy, from depositors, say, and lends it to businesses. Now I want to focus on the main argument today, which is the role that trust plays in that whole financial process. So trust is pervasive at many levels of the financial system, in large part because of the asymmetric information I was talking about earlier. There is the trust, the fundamental trust between the depositor and the bank. The depositor is trusting that her funds are safe with the bank that she's put the money in. And the most obvious example of this, or the most famous embodiment of this, is in Frank Capra's movie, It's a Wonderful Life, where Jimmy Stewart saves the day with a paean to trust to stop the run on the bank. As you recall in the movie, there's a run on the bank and Jimmy Stewart basically stands up and explains why the money is safe with the bank, that you have to trust that the bank has done the right thing. Trust of this sort is particularly important because banks undertake maturity transformation, which is roughly what Jimmy said in the movie. That is, the banks borrow short and lend long. For example, banks are willing to let you deposit your money at call, that is, you know, just overnight, but they lend the money, obviously, for considerably longer periods than that. If depositors all lost trust in a bank at the same time, as in a bank run, the bank would be unlikely to be able to repay the funds immediately. It could not call in all its loans the next day. It would be forced to engage in a fire sale of its assets, which are mostly illiquid loans. So to prevent this situation occurring, central banks traditionally have provided a liquidity backstop. They stand ready to lend money to banks, if needed, against the bank's assets or collateral. The trust in these arrangements provided by central banks is almost always enough for them not to be needed. So the ability of a central bank to stand behind the banking system and provide that liquidity backstop is another important element of trust in the financial system. There is also trust between the borrower and the bank. The bank is trusting that the borrower will repay the loan when it becomes due. The bank can do a lot of due diligence on the borrower to be reasonably confident that the lender will repay, but ultimately there has to be some trust involved. The bank needs to trust that the borrower has provided accurate information and that the borrower will act in good faith. There will, however, always remain a gap between what the bank can learn through its due diligence and what it needs to be completely confident that the loan will be repaid in full. Because the process of financial intermediation often has a number of links in the chain, there also needs to be trust between financial institutions. Many financial transactions don't just involve one bank lending out its deposits to the end borrower. Often the funds are lent from one institution to another before ultimately finding its way to the end borrower. So trust needs to be present at every stage in the chain. One breakdown in this chain of trust between counterparties can throw a spanner in the works of the whole process. So as I've said a few times already, ultimately there is only so much due diligence that can be done. Risk is always going to be present in the financial system. The question is how well it is managed. Information asymmetries will always be present between the two parties in a financial transaction. Transparency can reduce, but it can't eliminate the risks from those asymmetries. Finally, in addition, the final channel of trust I want to talk about is that historically there has been trust between regulators and financial institutions. I'm not sure there's actually all that much of this trust around at the moment, as I'll explain in a minute. But If I go back to the period before 2007, trust me, I know what I'm doing, was the banker's exhortation for the light touch approach to regulation that was pervasive prior to the crisis in many countries, most obviously the UK. The argument put prior to 2007 was that banks should be broadly left to their own devices, with the discipline provided by the market deemed sufficient to keep them on track. The regulators should basically, broadly speaking, stay out of the way. So now I want to turn to the breakdown of trust. Having described the critical role that trust plays in the process of financial intermediation, I will now describe how trust has broken down over the course of the financial crisis of the past 5 years. So that period leading up to the financial crisis saw what might be labelled, in the context of my talk today, the development of lazy trust. Things were generally going along fine, so my due diligence was that I would just take you, the lender, at your word. I won't really bother to verify that what you are telling me is actually the truth. I won't bother to consider the possible circumstances that might arise, which means that you won't actually repay me. Moreover, with long chains of intermediation involved, as for instance the example I described earlier of the US subprime situation, there was often way too much distance, in that case both geography as well as financial, between the ultimate holder of the risk and the source of the risk. Too many links mean that details get lost or misheard. If the due diligence is necessarily incomplete by the very nature of financial transactions, then that incompleteness is likely to get magnified the more chains there are in the transaction. The due diligence gets dissipated along the chain. There is often a presumption that someone further up the chain did the due diligence, and when times are good, no one bothered to challenge that presumption. So prior to 2007, complacently set in, encouraged by the seemingly benign growth in the world economy. That benign environment led to an incorrect pricing of risk. Now, this need not be the case, but it does seem to be a trait of human behaviour that has been evidenced many times in financial history. Good times beget complacency. So let me take a quick detour here. Taken to the extreme, this line of argument leads to a view of the world most famously associated with some Austrian economists. So in economics, it's actually called an Austrian view of the world. So this view of the world is that good times are always setting us up for the next disaster. Now, if you take that argument to extreme, basically it says we should never actually enjoy good times, and some of the proponents get very, very close to actually saying that. That's a proposition that I just don't agree with. It's not clear to me what the appropriate policy, though, should be to this. Certainly, it does not mean we should avoid good times altogether. One should certainly also remain alert to the possible dangers. And as certainly it may also be difficult to take away the punch bowl when the party is in full swing. Some of you may be familiar with the expression as a description of the traditional way of doing central banking, which is turn up to the party and take away the punch bowl just as it gets going. This is also why central banks are naturally never invited to good parties. But surely it doesn't mean that we should never have good times, as I've said, and instead endure a continuing period of mediocre performance so that no one ever gets carried away. Obviously, there needs to be some balance here. And to some extent, one can do the calculus, and the period of the last few years actually gives us some idea about what might be involved. The large costs of the current financial crisis in many countries does make one think hard where one should have let the previous boom persist for so long, as great as the benefits of that boom were while they lasted. But another aspect of human nature is the belief that one can avoid the mistakes of the past by learning from them. Inevitably, therefore, there is the ubiquitous assertion that this time it is different. And in many aspects, each time it is actually different. It is easier to assess the differences than the similarities in real time with previous historical episodes. The similarities only generally become apparent after the fact, and the similarities are often pointed out by many commentators after the fact rather than before the fact. Anyway, with that short interlude, let me come back to the main point of trust. As mentioned earlier, we do actually need some level of distrust, at least initially, for the financial system to function effectively. I shouldn't take you completely at your word. I should do some background checking to make sure that what you're actually telling me is actually true. I should check periodically whether your circumstances have changed, so I can be confident that you will still be able to repay me. So to the breakdown of trust. Sometime around 2007, it became clear to many in financial markets that there had been a major misassessment of risk in many parts of the financial system. While some had been warning about this misassessment of risk prior to 2007, and some had even positioned themselves to benefit from this misassessment, as Michael Lewis described in The Big Short, it wasn't until the middle of 2007 that this became a more widely held opinion. Interestingly, through the second half of 2007, there was a marked disconnect between equity markets around the world and credit markets. Credit markets came to the realisation significantly earlier, generally sometime around the middle of 2007, that something was going badly wrong in the financial markets. But for quite a considerable period of time, equity markets assumed nothing worse than a garden variety economic slowdown was in prospect. Moreover, as I said, a number of people had noted that risk had been significantly mispriced before 2007. So while there were a number of people that can claim to say that they saw it coming, very few people actually had a good sense of how exactly it was going to manifest itself when it did. So as I said, there were a lot of people who said, I told you so, but with most of that came with the benefit of hindsight. So in 2007, lazy trust evaporated. The financial system switched rapidly from complacency to deep mistrust in a very short period of time. Trust broke down between financial institutions, best illustrated by the final days of Bear Stearns in March 2008 and then Lehman Brothers in September later that year. Both of those two institutions experienced a run on them by their financial counterparties, who were unwilling to roll over their funding because of the concerns that the poor quality of the assets on the balance sheets of those two institutions might render the two institutions insolvent. And in Lehman Brothers, that again actually turned out to be the case. The crucial distinction between uncertainty and risk came to the fore. Let me explain a bit what I mean here. I can assess the riskiness of an asset or an institution by assigning a probability to its likely value. I can then manage that risk appropriately. So risk is quantifiable. But if I am uncertain and am unable to make a firm assessment about that value, the situation is a lot worse. I'm likely to pull back and be unwilling to provide any finance to you except on steep terms and probably only for a very short period of time. So uncertainty is much more pernicious than risk. And as I've spoken about on another occasion, the famous Rumsfeldian quote very much applies to the financial crisis. Risk is very much about the known unknowns, the quantifiable unknowns. Uncertainty is much more about the unknown unknowns. And the unknown unknowns were what suddenly became very prevalent in 2007. But rather than quote Rumsfeld at you, or maybe Mark Twain puts it a lot better and simpler, as he invariably does. So Mark Twain said, "It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble, it's what you know for sure that just ain't so that really gets you into trouble." Financial institutions and investors knew that many assets in the financial system were badly mispriced. In the case of some financial institutions, they knew about their mispricing on their own books and rightly assumed that the same thing was probably going on with all their competitors, but they didn't know how much. So the known unknowns were that these problems existed. The unknown unknowns were just how large the problems were and which particular institution was suffering the most from them. They did not know what exposure various financial institutions had to these mispriced assets. So what in economic parlance is termed counterparty risk aversion became all pervasive. Counterparty risk aversion basically means I just don't trust you. The lack of trust meant that financial institutions were only willing to lend to one another for increasingly shorter periods, ultimately overnight. So the night before Bear Stearns collapsed and the night before Lehman Brothers collapsed, basically all their financing was overnight. So when they turned up to work the next morning, the CFO at Bear Stearns and the CFO at Lehman Brothers suddenly found that no one was willing to lend them any more money. So a financial markets version of the bank run portrayed in It's a Wonderful Life took place. In the UK, in the case of Northern Rock, a traditional bank run occurred. Depositors in that institution became concerned about the safety of their savings. They no longer trusted Northern Rock because they were uncertain about its ability to fund itself, given its reliance on mortgage-backed securities for funding, a market that was no longer functioning at all because of a lack of a trust in the value of these securities. This breakdown in trust led to a breakdown in intermediation. Central banks stepped into this hole to play their historical role of intermediary of last resort. Central banks can replace, to a reasonable extent, the decline in intermediation of funds by the banking system, but it is considerably more difficult for central banks to replace the lost trust. The extent to which central banks have needed to be intermediary of last resort is evident in the vast size of central bank balance sheets in major advanced economies, in the euro area, the United States, Japan, and also the UK, where central banks are now running into the trillions of euros, dollars, or yen. The central banks are standing between financial institutions that are unwilling to lend directly to one another. And the euro area provides a particularly clear example of this. In the second half of last year, banks in the euro area became unwilling to lend to each other. First of all, they'd only lend to each other against collateral, rather than lending directly to another bank without any security. In plain English, this means that banks were only willing to lend to another bank if the borrowing bank would provide something like a government security or portfolio of mortgages as collateral. Then, even if the collateral was provided, the length of time they were willing to provide that loan for shortened, because of a concern that the borrower would just not survive long enough to repay the loan. This placed some financial institutions in significant financial difficulty. Concerns mounted as to whether some institutions would survive at all. As a result of this, the European Central Bank announced late last year that it would provide as much funds as banks in Europe required through three-year loans. So the ECB stepped in to provide funds to banks for three-year loans because no one else basically would. So the European Central Bank has become the intermediary of last resort for the European banking system because the banks simply don't trust each other. More recently, as the lack of some trust of some of the governments of Europe has intensified, the ECB has had, in effect, indicated its willingness to act as intermediary of last resort to these governments too. That was basically what they announced a few weeks ago. One of the main reasons the ECB has decided to do this is because of the lack of trust in the longevity of the euro, the currency itself. Investors are concerned that the possibility of redenomination risk, the possibility that they are left holding an asset who they thought was valued in euros but instead might end up being valued in something like a new drachma, will leave them with a lot less value than they thought they had. As a result of this mistrust, we are witnessing a balkanisation of the financial system in Europe, and I use the word balkanisation given the area of the world we're actually talking about, with possibly the same sort of consequences. Investors in one European country don't trust banks or governments in other countries. They are pulling back from financing across borders, preferring instead to invest their money closer to home. This almost certainly is not an optimal allocation of funds to their most productive use, which is what financial intermediation is generally supposed to be all about. On top of this dangerous state of affairs in Europe and amplifying the diminution of trust in the financial system, recent controversies in the banking system have hardly provided any justification for the public regaining trust in the banking system. So maybe sometime around 2010, trust was gradually being restored in some parts of the banking system. However, I think that has basically been shattered by the recent revelations surrounding the LIBOR scandal in the UK, allegations of money laundering by large global banks and the like. So all in all, we're not in a particularly happy state of the world right at the moment. So now let me finish by talking hopefully about something a little more positive, which is how we might go about restoring trust in the banking system, about the road out. So as I said, the state of the financial system in many parts of the world is not in good shape. So what is to be done about it? As in the old Irish saying, the first response is to say, I wouldn't start from here. But unfortunately, here is where we actually are. So using the recent experience in Europe as an example, we can consider a number of possible avenues as what might be done to rebuild trust in the financial system. When it comes to the distrust of the state of banks' balance sheets, transparency about the true nature of the assets on their balance sheet will clearly help. But the transparency and the disclosures clearly need to be credible to reduce those information asymmetries I was talking about earlier. Stress testing of the balance sheet by a credible independent party, such as the equivalent of APRA, can give depositors and other institutions, other investors, confidence that their money will be safe. These sort of actions work to take the solvency risk off the table. That is, they work to take the risk off the table that the institution just isn't going to be around sometime in the future. For depositors, this is reinforced by the presence of deposit guarantees. That is, some system which basically says that your deposit, at least up to some value, will be made whole regardless of whether if the bank happens to fail. But often it is the government who is providing that deposit guarantee. So if there is a lack of trust in the solvency of a sovereign, as we're seeing in a number of countries in Europe at the moment, this interlinkage between the financial sector and the government can amplify the problem. And the best two examples of that around at the moment are Ireland and Spain. In both those two countries, both governments coming into the financial crisis actually had pretty sound finances. Both, however, had fairly large banking systems. In Ireland's case, the banking system was about 6 or 7 times the size of the actual economy. Both banking systems in those two countries got themselves into a fairly large amount of trouble, mostly relating to property, and both residential and commercial property in the two countries. In both cases, the government stepped in to guarantee the banking system, most obviously in the case of Ireland. So the Irish government went from a situation where it had not much debt at all to suddenly having debt which was around 5 or 6 times the size of the economy because of the fact that it had to guarantee the banking system. So just having the sovereign standing there behind the banking system, while potentially one way of enhancing the trust in the banking system in those two cases, all that ended up doing was pulling the government into the same problem of distrust that the banking sector was actually into. The willingness of the central bank to provide a liquidity backstop, which is very evident in Europe at the moment, may be another potential avenue to reduce liquidity risk concerns. Investors, when there's a liquidity backstop in place that the central bank has provided, hopefully investors are not so concerned that they will be ones left in the burning building when everyone else has run to the exit. The quid pro quo for this support coming from the central bank or coming from the government is that banks will be subject to more comprehensive regulation and, at least as important, more intensive supervision and scrutiny by their supervisors than was the case before the crisis. The light-touch approach to regulation is no longer acceptable. That has most clearly been acknowledged in the UK, where they've had a marked change in their attitude to regulation, certainly from that existed prior to 2007. In Australia's case, one can make a reasonable case that this actually doesn't require much change, thankfully. APRA has long exercised intensive scrutiny over the Australian banks that it supervises. But even here in Australia, there are a number of lessons learned through the crisis that are in the process of being applied. So the fact that we have, by and large, avoided the financial crisis here doesn't mean that there are not a number of lessons that can be learned from the experiences of other countries. And hopefully we can take advantage of those lessons and avoid the mistakes before making them ourselves. The regulatory regime for financial institutions around the world has tightened considerably. And while this might impose some cost on the financial sector and increase the cost of financial intermediation, the benefits are sure to outweigh those costs. This is particularly the case when we see the terrible costs of the high unemployment being experienced in a number of countries around the world at the moment in the aftermath of their financial crises. A change in management practice at financial institutions is surely also necessary in a number of cases, and this must start at the top. The culture around risk management and risk tolerance clearly is an important element of this. The practices that became pervasive throughout the first part of this century that contributed to the excesses that came about need to change. What was considered an acceptable way of doing business will no longer suffice. Given the role that the financial sector plays in the economy, there is a form of social contract between it and the general public. The general public is trusting that the financial sector will do the appropriate job of providing the financial intermediation. The financial sector gets that extra level of support from things like a liquidity backstop, from things like deposit insurance that other parts of the economy don't get. And I think that provides some form of social contract that requires the banks to act appropriately. But leverage implies that financial institutions, notwithstanding all that support, are more vulnerable, and we need to consider what the safe degree of leverage that a financial institution should actually have. That is a debate that is currently being had around the world. The rate of profitability in the financial sector is also a debate society needs to be having. If financial institutions are perceived to be earning too high a rate of profitability, particularly if the institution is enjoying a degree of support from the public sector, that too will impede the restoration of trust. The fact that the financial sector enjoys a number of safeguards that other sectors don't enjoy means that also, that, and to the extent that regulation is making the financial systems a much securer and stronger sector than it used to be, means that one can ask the question as to whether shareholders in financial institutions should continue to earn the same rate of return that they have in the past. From a risk point of view, the fact that institutions are now safer may mean that the risk-adjusted return doesn't need to change, but that means the actual rate of return that financial institutions are delivering, the rate of profitability of financial institutions should arguably be lower than it was prior to 2007. So, to conclude, it will be a long road back to restore trust. As I said earlier, when trust is shattered, it certainly takes a long time to rebuild, and any setbacks along the way are certainly going to make that road a lot longer. Without trust, however, the process of intermediation and credit provision will be greatly curtailed, and that is certainly what we are seeing in many parts of the world at the moment. In turn, that lack of provision of credit will impede the path to global economic recovery, with costs to all of us, even here in Australia. We have to lay out the road ahead, put down the road rules in the form of regulations and other curbs on the financial sector, but then the journey still needs to be taken. Unfortunately, I think that journey is going to be a very long one, and we still have quite some way to run. And again, unfortunately, to finish on a slightly less positive note, there are no shortcuts. So with that, let me finish, and thank you very much for listening. So I'm happy to take any questions to the extent you managed to follow my thesis throughout that address. But anyhow, if there are any questions, certainly happy to answer some.
Thank you for your talk. Just one question. Would you like to comment on the role of the ratings agencies? Because they would perhaps be seen as providing some level of scrutiny, and they seem to have failed certainly in the last little while.
Yeah, actually got asked this question last week, so I've practiced to give the answer to that one. Rating agencies have a role to play. In the sense that, and it actually comes to the point I was talking about in my speech about due diligence. It's difficult for an individual depositor or an individual investor to do the due diligence on all the companies out there. And rating agencies can provide a sort of collective good, if you want to put it that way, by doing the due diligence for them. On the assumption they actually do that due diligence well, obviously. And I think if you think about corporations, and if you actually look what's happened, by and large, the rating agencies have actually done a reasonably good job. Most of their ratings, when it comes to corporations, turned out to be about right. When it comes to particularly a lot of the products which caused a lot of the problems during the most recent financial crisis, the ratings obviously were a long way away from the truth. And that clearly was a problem. I also think when it comes to governments, it's slightly more... It's more difficult to argue that rating agencies actually have a role to play. If an individual actually has a fairly good idea about the state, particularly of their own government's finances, and they don't really need a rating agency to tell them what's going on there. As I said, when it comes to a corporation where it's much easier, much harder for an individual to actually understand what's going on, then yes, there probably is a role. And actually, as I said, those ratings have turned out to be fairly accurate, even through the financial crisis. When it comes to other more exotic products, clearly there was a deficiency. When it comes to sovereigns, it's not clear to me that there's much role for a rating agency at all.
As a central banker, would you care to comment on central banks printing money?
Well, that's what we do, is print money. The question is how much, right? If you look at the actions that central banks have taken around the world, I mean, I think... You know, they have. It's difficult to know what the counterfactual is, what would have happened if they hadn't done what they'd done. But I think you can make a pretty strong argument that things would have been as bad as they are. Things would have been a lot worse if they hadn't done what they'd done. So as I said during my talk, central banks have had to step in where financial intermediaries have pulled back. So the fact that central banks are, at least on the surface of it, printing a lot of money, if you look at the overall credit in the system, that's actually smaller than it was 5 years ago. So central banks have had to step in to fill that void that's been left by the financial sector. So, and the manifestation of that is, at least in the common vernacular, is that they're printing money. But as I said, I think it's, the evidence is fairly clear that what they've done has stopped something a lot worse from happening.
Thank you, Dr. DeBell. That was a very interesting speech and very insightful, detailed analysis of the financial crisis. My question relates to the contrary policy settings that it seems to be taking place around the world. We've got easy monetary policy with quantitative easing, bond buying programs and the like, and also in Australia with reductions in interest rates. But the contrary position being taken with fiscal policy being tightened, particularly in Europe, we've seen a lot of austerity measures. We've got in the United States the emerging fiscal cliff problem. We've got ballooning fiscal deficits and so on and so forth that are trying to be unwound. So how do you perhaps reconcile the two positions where you've got easy monetary policy and contrary, a very constrictive fiscal policy, potentially sending confused signals to investors and the like?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, and it's sort of at the crux of certainly what's going on in Europe and the US and the UK, for that matter, at the moment. The difficulty, certainly in Europe and certainly in some countries in Europe, is that the sovereign itself is having trouble financing. So the austerity is, to some extent, to try and put those finances on a more sustainable footing. Personally, I think that designing a plan to put your fiscal situation on a more sounder footing for the medium term is certainly sensible, but some of the short-term austerity measures, I think, have probably been detrimental. I mean, the risk is that with the tightening in fiscal policy that has occurred, particularly most obviously in Spain, Greece, and to some extent Italy, is actually leading to the macroeconomy being even weaker, which in turn is actually making the fiscal situation worse, not better. And I think there's a danger. There's certainly a danger, and I think there's a reasonable argument can be made that that's actually what's happening in those countries at the moment. But it is a difficult problem because without some sort of policy response, those fiscal situations in some of those countries are on very clearly on an unsustainable path. The question is, over what time frame should they be made more sustainable? And that's a particularly difficult question to answer. Any more? Otherwise, I'm happy. One more down front.
Hi, Guy. Thanks. I'm Jason Bryce from Market News International. I think in the RBA's financial stability review yesterday, I'll paraphrase, the RBA said the share of deposits in the total funding of Australian banks continues to rise, putting pressure on their funding costs, which could increase further as competition for deposits continues. Could you put a time frame on that? When does the RBA expect that banks might have to increase their lending rates in response to the increased proportion of funding coming from deposits?
I've talked about that at length on other occasions, but basically it's not a question about the future, it's describing what's happened in the past. So as you're all aware, at least those of you who are savers — I'm not a saver, I'm a borrower, unfortunately — but for those of you who are savers, may be well aware that the amount of money you can get by putting your money on deposit with a bank, the interest rate you get is a lot better than it was a few years ago. So the Australian banks have obviously increased their deposit rates in part reflecting the fact that they want to move their funding structure to something which is a bit more dependent on deposits than it was in the past. But by and large, so there's a lot of competition in the deposit market in the Australian banking system at the moment, which is making the cost of the funds for the Australian banks more expensive, at least from that channel. And that's why they've tended not to move their lending rates down as the Reserve Bank has lowered the cash rate. But by and large, that process, I think, at least as of today, has mostly run its course. That doesn't mean we're not going to see further rises in funding costs in the future, but at least as of today, that process has mostly run its course. And at least in Australia, unlike in many other countries around the world, the Reserve Bank actually has the scope to try to offset the effect of those rises in funding costs on lending rates. Okay, so there, I will leave it there. Hand over.